The following podcast is not relating to my teachings and work at Del Cid Medical Center and is for entertainment purposes only.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to show 142,000 of The Life of Flow. Today, we have a good friend of the pod, Dr. Constantino Peña. He is the section head of interventional radiologists over at Miami Cardiac and Vascular Institute. And today, we had a great conversation, really. Reminiscing on a lot of the work that we've done, OUS, specifically in Latin America, and how that's morphed a lot, and then a lot about also his involvement in the International Multidisciplinary Conference, ISET, which is happening not too far from now, in the next month, and discussing about how that's morphed into something pretty incredible and developed into what it is today. So I guess without further ado, we'll dive into talk to Tino a little bit, okay?
Vamos.
Let's do it.
Two vascular surgeons walk into a bar and come out with a podcast. We are talking everything vascular and not. Welcome to the Life of Flow podcast.
Man, oh man, has this batch been just full of really
this
good,
has been a great batch.
Good talks.
Great batch.
You know, Tino, what we do, let me shine light a little bit here at a behind the scenes. So, you know, Lucas and I are really good friends. He did vascular surgery under me a few years ago, many years ago. Now he's killing it out in Austin. And so we elected to do this, but we have to be smart about how we do it because we can't. You know, we can't be spending time on a weekly basis. And so we came up with this idea that every like 2 or 3 months, we would get together somewhere and then line up, you know, our friends, 6, 8, 10, and then have these intense conversations for 48 hours. And then we just go back to our lives. And so we have enough, you know, material for a couple of months and then we do it back again. And today we're actually at a ranch in Sealy, Texas, and so middle of nowhere. Mm-hmm. But there's emus walking that I can see. There's donkeys, cows, and so Lucas, my baby, which by the way his name has nothing to do with him. He's out there playing and being a crazy and enjoying. Yeah, so we get to have the families here, and then we build a little purpose, little amateur studio, and then we rock it. And so. Anyway, all to say, all of that was just to say, man, thank you very much for accepting it. This is a Saturday. It's your family time. It's your own time, but we love to have you. And I'm sure it's just going to be wonderful to have a conversation with you. Thanks for being here, man.
Great. You know, looking forward to it. Always a chance to have an opportunity to talk with you, Miguel, and talk to the community of listeners that you have. I think it's always a great opportunity.
How did you guys meet?
I'll let Tino kind of shine some light.
I remember meeing Miguel. I'm trying to figure out if it was before Colombia or after Colombia.
No, I think you and I met in Colombia for...
Okay, that was our first meeting.
My recollection is Luis Cruz.
Right.
He's a good friend of ours, interventional radiologist.
Oh, we need to invite Luis.
Luis is such a fun guy.
I know.
Yeah, for one of the Spanish ones, we'll invite him.
Okay.
Anyway, he's in Medellin. He's a phenomenal IR, very busy guy out there. And I don't even know when this was. I mean, this has to have been 15 years ago or something like that.
15, that's what I was thinking.
And anyway, he's like, hey, brother, ven pa'. Oh, well, anyway, I can't do the Colombian accent. But anyway, he invites me there and he's like, oh, I invited this other guy. He's really cool. And that, I think that's where we met. It was like a summit of endovascular updates or something. And then like every good trip to Colombia, we ended up also sharing some amazing local rum. some rum and coke and great discussions. And you know, the rest is just a beautiful history of a friendship, of education, of expansion. And I guess maybe that's a great place to take this. Mm-hmm. 'Cause Tino, you and I, and actually Lucas, because I've also dragged him into this whole thing. He's been to Hendolat a few times now, and hopefully he'll continue to find the time and the interest to doing this. But you and I share a very particular thing that I think a lot of the other folks in the speaker circle maybe don't get to do a lot of, which is we have a connection internationally, but probably a little bit more tight with Latin America. And it's allowed us to be part of a lot of these scientific forums in the Latin American region. And, you know, when I look at, if I need to reaccommodate my time, which I have in the last couple of years, and I said, listen, I'm gonna do a little bit less traveling and you know, a little bit more family time and focus on my, you know, hope, the project that I got together. But anyway, the ones that I could not remove, like I took Viva away, for example. That's a big, everybody's like, why, you're not going, well, I just felt like I needed, you know, here or there, I can change. But what I won't forego is my regional activity in Latin America. And there's just a very special undertone of what that means. And I think that you've had a little bit of that. So maybe from your perspective, what has that, you know, collaboration south of the border with so many great colleagues and people, has, what has that meant for you? Why is that potentially a special thing we keep doing and we keep finding time to do?
You know, I think if I look at some of the things that I've done that has been more, you know, fulfilling personally, it's been those relationships with our friends and colleagues in Latin America and South America. I think early on we identified, at least I identified, that there was a need, and that, you know, there's a lot of really great people that, you know, may not have the opportunity to get the same interactions we are getting here in the United States. And, you know, being able to connect with them, being available, being able to go down there when they have events and kind of, you know, speak with them, show them new devices, show them what we're doing. Really, to me, was fulfilling. I've gotten to meet really great people throughout, you know, Latin and South America. These are people I consider really close friends now. And, you know, you connect in a different level. And I think to me, it's really fulfilling to do that. And, you know, they've made my life a lot better. And, you know, I love to see them when they come to the States now and teach me. And, you know, you're always learning, right? It's not like I'm the only one learning. I'm learning a lot from them. And it's something that I learned very early on. I remember I share a story that my father had told me. My father was an intro radiologist. And I think it was one of my first trips. And he had said, you know, he trained really with the godfathers of IR, one of the first generations of IR. And he had told me about how, you know, they were doing these portal procedures and, you know, sticking the portal vein and access into the spleen. And, you know, they were using, you know, in those days, it was like 8 French devices and stuff. And they had their series about 20 patients and what have you. And he went to Brazil and he's presenting and showing what they're doing. And people got up and were showing series of like 120, 200, you know, like, oh man.
But we do this every day.
Right. And it's like, you know, so right away, you know, you have the feeling of, hey, there's a lot of stuff going on. The world is very big and there's a lot to learn. And I mean, I remember told me that story before I even left. And I think that to me was really important. And that's really what I've seen. And it's to me, it's allowed me to really create great friendships. And that to me is really the strength of it.
When you guys started the, you know, back in the day, how had the needs changed as far as teaching, learning in these type of scenarios? Like, you know, I imagine...
You mean regionally in the Latin American region?
Regionally, and maybe if you can expand, you know, compare and contrast to the U.S., you know, because you were talking about, you know, pedal access. That's right now, that's maybe overdone in the comfort circle. You know, there's a lot of things that you guys, you know, brought to the front, which, you know, is there a need right now for those things? So I don't know, how have things changed as far as like what the need is when you go put up these conferences regionally and then bigger conference like ISIT? I don't know if you can talk a little bit about that.
I think maybe the I think they deserve different. I would kind of split the conversation up a little bit, and we can talk. Let's leave like what the new generations and kind of that change towards a little bit further down, and let me just focus a little bit on the part of your question regarding Latin America. 15 years ago or so, I remember, to give you how stark the contrast is, because you know Tino just alluded to something very interesting, which is, you know, we went there to teach them. And now it's not rare that a company will be like, hey, I'm going to fly a proctor from Latin America mm-hmm. to teach you.
Yeah.
So that's how quick it's changed. And obviously, it's very, listen, if there is a heterogeneous place in the world is Latin America, you just can't put them all in this. It's very different. It's very difficult to level them, right? Even when you look at populational analysis, they can't even go country by country. It's more like, you know, upper class or middle class or lower class when you're trying to identify risk patterns and dietary constrictions and so on and so forth. So anyway, but I'll say this. 15 years ago, I was invited to give a talk in Monterrey, Mexico. And it was a group of vascular surgeons that had purchased, the hospital had purchased a cath lab, a new hybrid OR. And it was locked. Because they did not know how to access and put a sheath and do an angiogram. And so I remember going there and for like 2 or 3 days, giving a talk on ultrasound guided access of the groin, of the femoral artery. Mm-hmm. And it was just like longitudinal, transversal, the needle, the micro. And then I remember the next talk was about angiogram. What's the good projection? When do you do RAO and LAO? And what are you looking for? And how do you focus on the foot? And, you know, all these things. Fast forward 2024, one of those guys from that same group came to us to show us, you know, some like new device that they had developed. You know, something totally different. I want to say it was a new thermal photo ablation for the greater saphenous vein that they had developed in Monterrey in a lab where they do endovascular tools, where they've now purpose-built catheters for the local market. And so that story just for me summarizes what's happened in that many years of development, because I just think that the territory was ripe, the disease was there, the hands and the technical skills and the medical knowledge is far beyond a lot of times what you see in the US. And it was just like they needed access to the tools. Like it was a matter of having the companies come, put the basic devices there, and then have some of us almost like give them a little push. You know, I don't know if you have any stories where you came in at a place where it was really, and then in the last years, it's just poof, exploded.
I mean, I think you're 100% right. And, you know, we can't underestimate the need, right? So the need in Mexico was really great in terms of, you look at diabetic feet and you're talking about awareness, you know, in our Hispanic population in terms of those type of problems and, you know, them developing, say, okay, we need to go after this. We need to figure out how to solve this. And, you know, I think one of the first Latin American diabetic feet meetings, I think, was in Mexico and starting to create really. And one thing that I will tell you early on is there was really early on, you didn't really know if someone was a surgeon, a radiologist, angiologist, cardiologist. Everyone was, you know, you were trying, everyone was working together and just trying to move the field forward. It was at that time, it was so young that things were really growing and there was none of this kind of silos slowing things down, which I think was also a special moment. And that same thing, right? I remember going down there and even early on talking about how to perform coilings and how to, you know, the different imaging, a correlation with non-invasive and what we see on angiography. And, you know, it's incredible how quickly things have escalated and how complex now everything is in terms of the treatment plans as opposed to that. I remember when we were in Colombia, like you said, I think that was one of the first times they saw pedo access.
Yeah.
And I remember that because we did like cases there and it was like, okay. And then, you know, 2 seconds, all of a sudden into the posterior tibial artery. And, you know, we're in this crowd in the auditorium and it was just like, wow, did he just really do that? And doing that. So it's, you know, from that standpoint, really enriching and quick to see how quickly things change in terms of the breadth, the number of operators, the centers. I mean, Monterrey, like, you know, it was a small, that was a huge house. We do live cases out of there, you know, at meetings and a great, you know, number of people have gone over there that, you know, we know very well as our friends.
Yeah. 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 And actually to see the development of tools locally, I think that's been very impressive. You know, to have some of these facilities, I'm in Brazil, they built their own catheters. In Mexico, they're building their own balloons and catheters. And it's just progressing a lot. I think one of the huge challenges still will remain the fact that it's very expensive to get access to technology, which is something that I think here in the US we've been able to surpass at this point because the volume has sustained the growth of the business enough to where these companies don't need to kill you on every product. Right now, I mean, I could get a balloon for my office-based lab for $50, right? $25. I know it's ridiculous, but in Mexico, believe it or not, that same balloon can cost up to $300 to $500.
Really?
The same damn balloon. Huh. And the reason is because these are very big territories that don't necessarily have enough sustainable volume for companies to have a presence. And so what happens is that in order for you to, for let's say Cook or Boston, to get a catheter down to, let's say, Tuxtla Gutierrez in the south part of Mexico, well, guess what? It goes through two distributors. Oh, okay. So distributor A has Mexico City, and then distributor A actually has a sub distributor agreement with the distributor from the south. But guess what? Everybody's got to
take a cut.
Everybody needs a tax, right, to operate.
Yeah.
And then these taxes are kind of dumb sometimes.
Didn't Amazon solve this problem a long time ago?
You know, unfortunately, you're not there yet, but that's funny that you say that. And I'll tell you why. Because one time in a table like this at a Hendo lot many years ago, we were all, you know, having a drink or something. And I said, what if we do Hendo lot marketplace?
Yeah.
And what if we just have a place where you go online and you bulk purchase a bunch of balloons for, you know, for this particular price. And then they get delivered to your office because guess what? We don't need a rep, right? That's the thing is I think that the world has evolved to the point that you don't need the reps to be there to show you how to use a balloon. It's a damn balloon, right? Maybe a more complex device, yes. But some of the basics you don't need.
Not even. FaceTime. Well, it's called FaceTime.
Okay, yeah, yeah. But what I mean is you don't need the warm body there. You just need the device delivered. The thing about that is that then, you know, that kind of fizzled away because you need money to build. And then you need money to get all the permits through. And then to get a balloon, I want to say that me and a friend have a company. I want to say it's Russian or Chinese or something. And we've been trying to get a balloon approved in Mexico for like 5 years. So we haven't been able to get it through the COFEPRIS, which is their FDA, because it's just so unfortunately vised with corruption. And so if there's a change in government, the whole thing kind of goes, which has been the Achilles tendon, I think, of the region a lot of times, is I think their political...
I think it's Achilles heel, but that's okay.
Oh, sorry.
And it's very heterogeneous, right? Because every country is different. Remember Mexico, it was probably 10 or 12 years ago when they finally said, hey, we're going to include, if you get approved by the FDA or the EU, then we're going to be able to get approved there, you know? And then, but, you know, there's still other hurdles, right? It's cost, right? Cost of the hospitals, if you're in the hospital situation, how much budget did that particular hospital have and who's managing that budget, right? It's some of the stories of, you know, who decides when, you know, what grafting to get or what stent or balloon at that particular time. And, you know, what's that budget? And it's, there's a lot of challenges, which, you know, I think we also now are facing a little bit in the United States, but it's a whole different level. And then you just cross, you know, you cross the border to the next country, it's completely different.
That's so, and, you know, within a very small region, yeah, you realize there's a lot of different countries.
Yeah.
I remember, here's a side story. We were putting together the patio of our house, you know, and so I told Jenna, I was like, you know what would be nice if we carve the state of Texas, because here's where we live, and we carve the country of Costa Rica in wood, and we order them to be like kind of, you know, so we can put them on the wall.
Yeah.
And I wanted, you know, I told this company, they did it all like size appropriately. It was pretty cool.
Yeah.
And so I said, listen, I want a state of Texas that's like 2 by 2 feet, like a big thing. And I want to put it on the wall because everything in Texas is big, right?
Yeah.
And then I was like, and make a proportional size of Costa Rica, because I know it's probably going to be about the same size, you know, 2 feet and 2 feet in. And so we get this like big thing, and then we get this fucking small box. And I opened the thing of the state of Texas, and I was like, babe, look, it's beautiful. And I put it on the wall, right? And I like put the thing and I screwed it up.
Yeah.
And then Jenna opens up and he's like, oh, Costa Rica is so cute and tiny. And I remember looking at it and I was like, call this company. God damn it. They fucked it up. And I'm not joking. Like I went back and they're like, bro. And then the guy sends me an email and says, your country fits like 7 times in the state. And so I was so, it was so funny and embarrassing at the same time. Cause then I put them together and like still today they're like side by side and it's just like the sun and the moon, right? Like you just see this starking. But all to say, within like a state of Texas, you can fit 7 of these countries.
Yeah.
And every 2 hours you're in a different country. And every 2 hours you have an absolutely different set of tools. I mean, a set of norms and regulatory process and then politics and all these other things. So, but, you know, we do what we can. And I think that despite that, there are these trailblazers, these MacGyvers in every one of these countries, like Luis Cruz, like Mauricio, like Fabiani, like Muñoa, that are these guys that have just pushed and pushed and changed and moved that needle forward. And, you know, sometimes with their bare hands, right? Because have you ever been invited to do a live case, like locally? Have you ever done something?
I have. Tell me the story of
something that was like just really interesting for you because they made you work with something that you would have never like done or something like you had to adapt to something. And you're like,
You realize you have to do with you do with what you have, right? So I remember I'm going to tell you two different stories. Cause I think one was went to Colombia and we're in the military hospital in Bogota.
Okay.
And we just had the use of covered stents, right? And basically, we had a couple covered stents and we gave some lectures and talking about different things and the community was great. And then we had some cases that we were going to help out with in the afternoon. And it's incredible. Like the what you're helping and what you're seeing, you know. And I remember this one like it was yesterday. And this poor gentleman basically was, you know, at those days, there was, you know, there was still war between the factions in Colombia, and he was at the border, and they got into a traumatic injury, and he had created this really nasty AV fistula, traumatic AV fistula from a gunshot, and we treated it. You know, the plan was to treat it with this covered stent, but again, we had the covered stent. We really didn't have the right size sheath. And a wire, and you know, so it's like, okay, how are we going to do this and get it going? And you know, like you said, MacGyvering and figuring out what we had and get it done, and that went great. Another example is I remember doing an endograft, and it was a really first endograft in this Latin American country, and I got the grafts from the distributor, so I had the grafts, And it was a really tough case, Miguel. I mean, there were like a huge hypogastric artery aneurysm. And then we had the coil and, you know, what kind of coils were we going to use? And got a bunch of donations before I left and stuffed them into a bag. You know, all the coils I could find, right? I can tell you, we used every coil that I brought, okay, to stuff this thing. And in the middle of the case, we're doing it. All of a sudden, the power goes off. And they're like, okay, don't worry. Christ. And like, you know, we had to wait for like 15 or 20 minutes and the power came back on for a little bit. And then, you know, kind of finished the case and get it going. I remember, you know, I think I had a flight, you know, trying to figure out how to basically get out, you know, finish. We finished it, then run to, you know, had to get some, you know, local grub, very important, and then get to the airport to catch a flight. My whole thing about you're doing it, you're doing it with whatever you have, right? Like, I'm like, don't you have a wire? We have a wire, took the, you know, man dry the wire, used the wire as coil. And I'm teaching them basically all the stuff that we're doing. They're telling me, okay, this is how we get out of this. And then, you know, then you have the stuff you can't control. Power goes, right? And it's like, you know, the C-arm overheats. Because in those days, it was a C-arm. And man, super like fun in terms of getting it done. And, you know, it's what I do every day. That's how it's done every day. So it's all amazing.
I remember going to do some cases. And I was like, so do you guys have like wires? Oh, we have like all sorts of wires. It's like, okay, cool. So, you know, I get in there and, you know, I wanted a glide wire, basic glide wire, right? To go like up and over the perforation. This thing felt just like if you were, if you finished a marathon and somebody gave you a spoonful of flour. Just dry and weird. And I'm like, what is, I'm like, hey, wet this thing in. And I put it back in. I was like, I'm sorry, there's something up with this wire. Like, it's like, well, what? What's wrong with it? I was like, I don't know. It just doesn't feel slippery. Like it. Yeah. And they're like, oh, the coating rubs off after like the 20th time we reuse them. And I'm like, oh shit, can you? So, and then the guys are like, hey, do we have a X3? I was like, what is X? It's being reused 3 times. So go to the back. They're on the right-hand side. The tres R's. Resterilizaciones. So then there's the 3 R's or then the 10 R's. Yeah. And so they start dividing them up by how shitty the wire becomes after a while. And then you'd know which one to use. And so then it was like super fun. Because now I was like, okay, I'm in.
Yeah,
I'm in. I like this game. Because I'm like, hey, do you have a CTO wire? And the guy's like, you ever heard of a V18? I was like, yeah, but that's kind of like more of a workhorse. And he's like, no, give me a minute. Grabs a pair of scissors, cuts. He says, how many grams? And I look at him. I was like, what do you mean? That was Morelli. How many grams? And I was like, I don't know, like 15 grams. He's like, that's a centimeter and a half. And goes, snip, cuts the V18. I touch it in the wire.
Yeah.
Dude, perfect CTO wire. So made a little nick, boom, cross the lesion. Like I'm telling you, it's la malicia indígena, right? That I always say it's like, that's why they're always going to overpower us. They're just so good and they work with their nails and it's just been so fun to be part of it, right? And these are just good memories. You made me reminisce and I miss so much of it. And maybe I should try to do more of it again. It's been a while since I've gone to do live cases in places with absolutely nothing to do. But you know what the funny thing is? Now that I'm in my OBL, a lot of times where you don't have all this stuff,
no,
that's when all those moments come back where you're like, fucking no, I got to make this work.
Yeah, I got to make it.
I can't use 20 wires 18, for a case, right? Yeah, and so you start using all those little tricks from the past. Let's shift gears, guys, here. Because I really like to get to a really important project, which is ISED. ISED's been around. Now let's shift into an American-based meeting. I would say a trailblazing meeting for a lot of us. I want to say that back when I was a medical student, I was inspired by, at the time, TCT, ISED, probably Viva, or places where I'm like, I want to go there. I want to see this. I want to see the latest and greatest. I want to understand more about the information. And I mean, you've been involved probably most of your career. How far back does your memory of being part of ISED go? How many years has that been?
Tell you that exactly what you said in terms of getting inspired. Okay. I mean, I was a resident in Boston, and I'd say, okay, I want to do interventional radiology. And I remember going as a resident to ISET. Oh. And, you know, I had heard about it, but, you know, the attendee said, no, it's just a meeting.
This is what year? What year is this?
Well, this is going to be 1999. Okay. 1999, 1998, maybe. Okay. ISET in my region, ISET is now probably almost 40 years. It's probably about 38 years that they've been doing the meeting. So went down to Miami. It was just, you know, home for me where they have the meeting. And I basically, you know, go and sit in the meeting, and it was like super inspiring to just see all this different collaboration, seeing really people from all different specialties involved in these life cases. Because in those days, really, it was the original life case meeting. And in those, it was still very, very few meetings were doing it. Really learning of the decisions that people were doing, because you could read it and you can talk about it, but there, you know, live, you're trying to say, okay, what are we going to do now? Right. And seeing, you know, the decision-making process and how it worked. And then along with that is, you know, really meeting people from all around the world. The people that you had read the articles were there presenting. So you wanted to meet them and ask them questions. You saw people presenting new science. And then the whole, really, the show, right? Because there was also a show part of ISET where, you know, the resolution of the screens. Every year we'd seem to come up with these new, you know, how important the presentation of all the cases were. You know, in those days, they had a helicopter would fly basically in between cases from the hospital to the Fontainebleau and back and forth. And then that was part of it. And I still remember some of...
Wait, you know, the faculty would be back and forth?
The live case operators would go and basically, you know, they'd meet at the meeting and they'd run over there because you'd see them on the screen. And then like 20 minutes later, they're up in the podium giving a talk. Like, wow, like, how'd they get there? Like,
oh, that's cool.
Yeah, that's pretty cool.
Oh, and shit. Like, I can't believe I missed that.
Yeah, they would come, you know, and that's how they basically, you know, close that gap. And being able to see that, be able to listen, like, you know, you're just talking about it. And it was one case after another. And then every now and then you're paying attention. And, you know, they would also be throwing in little curveballs. I remember doing one case where they're talking about, I think it was the first simulator. I mean, must have been like 1999. And you're looking at a case and they're looking at, and they're doing something. And it looks like Bernardi's going to a coronary or he's doing something. And all of a sudden you zoom out and he's really on a simulator.
Oh,
and you're like,
no.
Oh my God. You know, like this is the kind of stuff that, you know, it was just overall the educational experience that I saw. And exactly what you said, it really inspires you when you start seeing all these people doing those cases and teaching, and you can say, okay, we can get this done. We can do this. And it's being there saying, okay, how do we do this at our hospital?
Was it Barry Katzen? Was that all him? Was that, you know, is he the godfather of that whole idea? Was there people, I don't know if there was somebody before Barry that pushed that forward.
No, I think Barry came with that because he had done few live case meetings in Alexandria at Fairfax Hospital before he joined and built the Institute. And, you know, we went from those small meetings to get it to ISET to where it was. Obviously, it's a team, right? It's a team approach. It's once a week meeting the whole year, at that time, all the program directors were really part of our team in terms of at MCVI. Now we have a multidisciplinary group, right? So we have vascular surgeons, we have vascular medicine, we have interventional cardiologists, you know, all working together, meeting every week in the morning, kind of come up with, hey, how do we make this better, right? But at the end of the day, it's really that thought process is, how do we make it better? What do we need to teach? Like, what do people want to come to a meeting for? And it's funny, over the years, multiple challenges, right? You have challenges of, hey, of a hurricane. That was a major challenge. Hey, there's a challenge of maybe life cases aren't the right way of teaching, right? There was a major area that articles in New England Journal, but hey, is this ethical? And how do you control that? And, right. and, you know, really we questioned ourselves, hey, you know, we have two or three people, main operators in every room, making sure that the patient is the number one thing that we're taking care of. Every case is selected because of a learning you know, there's a learning point to every case that we're trying to show.
But you're still doing life cases, right? That hasn't gone away, or did it go away?
That hasn't gone away. We still do it. It's still life cases. And now, you know, we've tried to make it even more diverse by bringing in other sites, right? So things that you may not do yourself, that you have other sites that great operators can come in and also be part of the meeting. I think that's how we continue to evolve and kind of make the meeting better to get everything in. And it's always a question of, okay, what do you need to present? What needs to be here? And Barry has always talked about, hey, we also have to think about what's new. What do people really need to hear about? Maybe they don't want to know about it, but we need to make sure they know about it now, you know? And, you know, AI, we had AI town hall 4 or 5 years ago talking about different things before they actually need to come. So people are prepared and already are adjusting to get things ready at their labs.
Very ahead of the game.
And what are those frontiers that you see now in 2024 where you're heading to? Like, where's the ball moving to?
You know, I don't want to sound repetitive, but I do think, I think we're going to be challenged with AI and how to best use that AI for education, for learning, for what we do every day. And I think it's going to be different. I think what we're seeing going forward is, you know, what used to be studies that we used to do with, you know, I think randomized controlled trials will still be necessary, but you're now seeing population-based studies that are based on, you know, 14,000, 15,000 people. That carries a lot of weight. And, you know, I think we're just learning how to actually do those studies right so that we eliminate a lot of the bias and they're actually, you know, so we can trust them as we move forward to make decisions. I think those are things. I think our treatment technologies and will continue to grow. And I think we're always faced with that same kind of challenge. I think even 10 years ago, hey, this new technology is coming out. How are we going to afford it? And how do we make a choice between you have 5 or 6 technologies to decide, okay, this is the technology that we're going to use? And is it because one technology is better for a particular patient, or is there going to be one technology that we're going to use and be the one that's a standard? And then, I mean, the whole thing, Miguel, what you're doing in terms of ambulatory care and looking at that, you know, that arena, I think is changing medicine, right? Without a doubt, it's going to change medicine. Will the pendulum swing back to the hospital? I don't know. It may never come back. I think you're going to get 2 different types of procedures being done in different areas. And, you know, it'll be very interesting where that line is drawn, because maybe there'll be no line. Maybe everything will actually be in the outpatient type arena.
I think that there's going to be an absolute necessity for the tertiary center of care for vascular care. What I do hope, and that's kind of what I'm here trying to do on my little old island in Houston, is that you create sound, reasonable, responsible, ethical care that is de-escalated, but that is all under one particular flagship. So you need these very basic centers of care for something as basic as a shoe fitting or an ultrasound, a follow-up. You then need another level of care where maybe assisted patency rate of a bypass valve that's retained, that's a simple 20-minute procedure, can be done. And then you need that integrated to the hospital for a quick and expeditious, you know, kind of suction all the way back up. And then the hospital provides the care that they have to do and then back down to the basics. So I hope that instead of what's happening now where you have these hospitals isolated from the OBLs and somewhat cannibalizing off of each other, that somebody says, you know what, done. I'm a hospital, but I'm going to go and buy, or I'm going to go and invest in creating this decentralized network, but it's all under my flagship, under my healthcare. And I know how to bring these patients up and bring these patients back down in a centered way. I'll figure it out. When I figure it out, maybe you guys can give me a job. I'll come to Miami and work with you, man. I've always told Tino I want to go to Miami one day.
Would you move to Miami?
Like in a heartbeat.
Really?
In a heartbeat.
I thought you hated Miami.
What are you talking about?
I don't know.
I hate the Fountain Blues pool with the whales in the middle of the night trying to mate. But
what?
I'll leave it at that. But I don't, you know, that's the raunchy side. Like that, okay, that kind of raunchy side of Miami.
That's what you
I don't.
Are you sure?
I love me Latinos down there. Yeah. That's a pretty good place. And it'd be a 1.5-hour flight down to San Jose to visit my dad.
You want to hear a funny story?
I don't know. Do I want to hear a funny story?
I don't know. Probably not.
Go.
We'll see about the funny story after that story.
That's what I'm saying. Like, what's your funny story?
When my contract was ending in San Antonio, I went to interview at the University of Miami. Did I tell you about this?
No, but yeah. I'm a little.
Yeah,
and then, I don't know if I want to hear this, but go.
It was good. They were interested, and then the pandemic happened, and they said, "Oh, there's a hiring freeze. We'll continue the conversation afterwards."
Okay.
And then 2 weeks after, they called me from Austin. It's like, "Hey, you want to come?" I said, "Yeah." And now I reflect back that I was like, if I had moved to Miami, Adam would have died an early death. Because it's hard for me to say no to things. There's a lot of things that are dangerous in Miami. But yeah.
Right, soundboard. There we go.
I know. Yeah. Anyway, so back to the... So one thing that I question is, I think inevitably, I mean, you have kids. And by the way, I've followed... How many kids do you have, Tino?
Four kids. Miguel.
Jesus.
Congrats.
What an amazing accomplishment. By the way, I'm so jealous. Now that I am a father of a 2-year-old, I want to have a football team. Like, yeah. I want to have 10 kids. Like, yeah. I'll have 30 kids if I could. Like, oh my God, what a pleasure. You've been, by the way, an inspiration in that sense, because it seems like you just love that job. Being a dad is just such a great job. But anyway, I don't want to digress. Yeah. What I'm trying to say is you can see it probably through them that they absorb information in a very different way. I mean, I put the stark difference when, you know, my dad walked into my room in 1996. And he looks around and he's like, my dad's a doctor. Mm-hmm. And so he's like, you're not a medical student. And I'm like in the depth of anatomy, like, you know, dissecting all nights and doing my whole things. I was like, what are you talking about that? He's like, you have no books? I was like, I have all these PDFs. Like I'm digital, you know, I have a lot of them online and I, you know, have all these. And so it was like the CD-ROM of the netter. And I would like pull the images up and right. And now, you know, fast that moment, he was like, okay, I can't believe you're going to be a doctor and you don't have books. Right. And still, I want to say I probably ultimately ended up buying 20 books. And now fast forward to where we're at now. It's not even that it's all online. There's nobody has a book, but it's all online. But then it's all now in your phone. You don't even need a desktop. And the way that people access that information and the way that social media has also kind of reprogrammed us to get bits and pieces of this tiny moments of attention and how you provide that. That's something that I question myself as also being part of a leadership in a meeting like Hendel in Latin America. Like, what do I do moving forward? Like from the teaching standpoint, how much do I need to shift? How much do I need to adapt? And how do I do so that I keep that content fresh, but not only the content by doing everything that's new and all the new devices and the research, but also the methodology. Like, how do we adapt the methodology? I'm curious if that's hit you guys' committees internally and how you guys think about this, you know, moving into the future of how to keep these meetings valuable for ultimately your client, which is the end user, right? The physician that you want and the nursing and the healthcare provider. How do you do that as people just internally seem to learn differently?
I agree with you. I agree with you that it's gonna definitely, there's changes, right? And I think a couple different levels, you know, you have it from a meeting perspective and you always ask that question, why do people come to a meeting? And why do people come to the meeting now, right? In 2025, why would you come to a meeting? And how's that going to add to the way people learn now? Two, you know, we're lucky enough that we're just starting a radiology residency. Our program now has, you know, Miami Cardiac Vascular Institute and Baptist Health is joined with Florida International University. So we now, those medical students, and we now have a residency, and we're going to be kind of rolling out residents in all different fields, including, we already have our interventional radiology fellowship dash residency, awesome. Then getting diagnostic radiology, vascular surgery, you know, all this is going to roll out. Awesome. And that's really where you start asking those questions. How do you educate, and how do you do things in that arena? And things are different right now. You know, not only, we always talk about, hey, there's less work hours and this and that, but it's also, how do you get the knowledge and the different experiences to my own kids? Like you alluded to, you know, college and, you know, seeing how everything is really web and it's really experiences, right? And you do all these group projects. Is that really the right way to learn? I don't know, but obviously there's people a lot smarter than me that decide that's really where a lot of that learning is done. So how does this affect our learning in terms of meetings and procedures? And, you know, and I think when we sit together in the meeting and talk about why do people go to the meetings, the key is the interaction, mm-hmm. is that networking, people talking face to face. And a lot of times if you ping somebody, you already ping them with a reason or an intent. But if you ping someone at a meeting, you're almost kind of blank slate. And you're listening what people are talking about and what they're excited about. And I think that kind of opens up your kind of plate of things that you want to see a little bit more. To me, that's really why I think these meetings are important. You know, why people would go to ICER or Endolite is because they want to see that community together and really ask them, hey, what are you going through? What are you going through? And then when people see, hey, you know what, four or five people are going through the same thing, hey, then maybe this is something we need to address, right? And I think that's where it is. But I definitely agree with you in that the way we learn is different. You know, it's like I used to print articles. Now I have to figure out, I got to make sure I can read them on my computer or on my iPad. That enough. That's like a challenge for me already, right? I can't highlight. And how do I save them? But, you know, I'm one of those few people that still has a bookshelf. I look around, I'm like the only person who has a bookshelf in my office. Most people don't even have bookshelves. So yeah, you're right. And I think we're always changing for the better, and we need to kind of be in front of that if we want to continue kind of to be leaders in that teaching and that education. And, you know, it's more than just edutainment, right? It's more than that. It's how do you make something where, you know, it's fulfilling and that you can reach, you know, your goal of continuing to kind of push things forward in innovation and understanding.
Yeah, I think you hit the nail on the head there, because, you know, we talked to
in
the
what sense, sir?
About the discussion and the nuance.
Got it. Okay.
Because we talked to Dr. Veith, and he kind of revolutionized things by having the 7-minute talk, right? And
five.
Also, with two for questions.
Yeah. Five with two for questions. Like speed dating.
Yeah. And you can have a lot of information, and then you can expand, because at that point, your access to that information was limited. Now, like I did this the other day, there's this thing called Notebook LM by Google. And then I put in the latest five articles on DVA, and it created a podcast with artificial intelligence, with artificial voices discussing those articles back and forth. So I don't
know. Like an actual community of people talking?
Like three people discussing the papers.
With inflections and, oh, yeah. Hi, hey,
with
like, that's
all
interesting.
The statistical analysis. Oh. It is crazy.
We should air on one.
Yeah.
Can we air one? No.
Yeah.
That's not us. Can we air?
Yeah, we can.
Like maybe we can just, I'm just saying, compute one and then air it as a show one day.
For
just
sure.
To see what,
yeah, for sure.
As an experiment.
I think we got
all right. Sorry.
Anyways, so there is no need, I think, anymore for the 7-minute talk. And I think, you know, we're transitioning it in it. I think in 10 years, there probably be very little of that. What there is a need for is the nuance, the art of medicine, the pondering, the creativity that comes with it. And, you know, I don't think we've developed a structure to bring that into a conference, but I think that that's where public conferences are going to go to. And that's why I have no interest in sitting here and discussing papers, because I see no point to that. I see the point of experience, of nuance, of like your philosophy in approaching a specific problem. But yeah, I wonder how conferences are going to, because that's how I see things moving.
I'll tell you my thought for Hendo a lot. We've discussed it at different points, I think, here in the past, but I think the audience has not surpassed, but has leveled with a lot of the speakers. You know, before, you know, exactly what we started talking, right? Like now some of them have become our teachers, you know, somebody like Mariano Ferreira in Argentina. I mean, that guy dance around me any day of the week with a complex aortic work. Fernando Mejia in Colombia. That guy will, you know, I'll send my dad if he ever needs a thoracic abdominal AAA. I ain't going to keep him here in the US. But anyway, so I think that we have to be respectful to the audience in that sense. I think that we need to stop thinking that they are far and far below us. Mm-hmm. And I think we have to start removing a lot of these basic knowledge things, create a space for that, right? Because there's always going to be a PGY1.
Yeah.
That maybe he wants to know how to size a AAA or, you know, what strategy to use. That there always has to be that. But then these forums should be complex case scenarios and almost like an open discussion, right? Like put the chairs at the same level, put the speakers at the same level, and then use people that actually have charismatic way to reveal information, that can build a good presentation, that shows clips of what they did and maybe edit into some live cases into that. Here's how I do it and what I can do. And that's what we've, you know, by the way, Tino Hendelat is in Costa Rica next year. So we're going back to our alma mater.
Roots.
And I hope that you can carve a little bit of time if you can. But because what we're going to do is it's going to be 3 days of just case discussions. We are essentially removing most of like data stuff. There'll be some industry stuff and they'll probably want us to discuss their latest and greatest data there. But most of the meat of the meeting is going to be just case discussions.
Yeah.
Technique discussions, alternatives for access discussions, you know? And I think that'll be interesting. I think that'll be interesting.
No, I think it'll be very interesting. Are you bringing the band together, your band back together?
I think I should. I think
you
should.
What's the band? Are you in a band? Are you in a fucking band?
I'll leave it at that. But I've.
Oh, Luca, you guys, there's a lot of material there. Man, that's a good. This is a good and old beast.
That's a future LOF episode right there.
That percussion. that percussion, right, bro?
You know, super they're like, impressive.
They're like
very, super impressive time.
They're like very famous. Like
you were in a famous band. Really?
Yeah. But anyway, we'll talk about that.
Are you on Spotify?
It wasn't. No. Let me correct. Right. I was absolutely not in a famous band. Okay. I was close with a few guys that sometimes I would jam with.
Okay.
That now, today, many years later, are absolutely like famous in like the setting of my country.
What instrument do you play?
I was in percussion. I did like a lot of bongos and tambor.
What?
Oh, come on. Get away from this. Stop laughing.
It was an amazing night. That's all I got to say.
I am not missing this.
It was
meeting.
A great party.
I'm not missing.
We're going to do the same thing.
Can you take it to ISET? It's Florida. I'm sure.
maybe. Yeah. When Tino offers me a job in a few years and I go to Miami, we'll do a party like that. How about that? All right, Tino, let's drop a plug on ISET. When is the date for 2025? It's around the corner. Do you have those dates clear?
Right around the corner, February 2nd to February 5th. We're going to be again in Hollywood at the Diplomat Hotel. Sunday through Wednesday, we're going to have multiple live case sessions coming from multiple places, not only Miami Cardiac and Vascular Institute, but also from Dr. Metzger in Columbus and Riverside.
Oh, wow.
We're going to have Darren Schneider also coming from UPenn. Mm-hmm. It's going to be a great different venues, a lot of great cases as usual. And on top of that, we have a lot of great discussions. We break that things down into, we're going to have things on embolizations, obviously CLI, arterial work, venous work. On Sunday, really get a focus with what we have as an essential session. So basically kind of a whole day essentials and vascular care. very popular. A lot of people come there to kind of fill gaps and see great stuff, really case-based. We'll have a lot of residents, fellows there in that situation. Also, we'll have a non-invasive day. So people that need non-invasive credits, some great speakers and topics on that. We're also going to have a half a day with nurse tech, going over, you know, again, new things that, you know, that are really aimed for that group. Usually every year we have something which is a town hall. So this year we're going to talk about controversies. You're going to hear about, great controversies, carotid stenting, how we treat aortic dissection, you know, how do we get some of these devices as they come out and are, you know, proven, how do we get them into our actual hands? How do we afford them? And, you know, how do we manage CMS and FDA and all these things? So those are, you know, just some of the topics we're going to talk about. Again, ICED is made to me because of our faculty, great faculty that come, the people that come in terms of our attendees and that interaction. So really a unique experience. So, you know, a plug to come out and join us. Will be a great time in South Florida in February. And that's another reason.
That's awesome. That's a great reason.
That's awesome. Well, Tino, listen, it's Saturday. It's been an hour and I want to give your time back to you. And really say from the bottom of our hearts, thank you very much for being here, man. You're a great dude. You're a great man. Very inspiring. And then I hope to continue, weaving our friendship and seeing your profession flourish even more. Thank you very much.
The same. It's an honor to be here. Love to be able to be with you guys in the life of life of flow. And a big fan. And hopefully we'll continue to have more people wanting to kind of listen and hear what we have to talk about and, you know, really down to earth discussions about, you know, what we do and how to make our life funner and better. So thank you very much. And great to see both of you. Thank you.
All right, man.
Thanks, Tino.
Pura vida. See you later. Bye-bye.
Two vascular surgeons walk into a bar and come out with a podcast. We are talking everything vascular and not. Welcome to the Life of Flow podcast.